You said we should look out further. I guess it wouldn't hurt us. We don't have to be around all these coffee shops. Now we got that percolator. Never made a latte greater. I'm saving $23 a week.
Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. This is episode 117, The Death and Life of Gentrification. I'm Dan Zafarik. Greg will be joining us shortly. Our guest today is Japonica Brown Saraceno, who's the author of The Death and Life of Gentrification. The book is a very interesting study of the concept of gentrification from several points of view. She is a professor of sociology and women's gender sexualities studies at Boston University, where she serves as faculty fellow at the Initiative on Cities. Japonica, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be in conversation with you guys.
So I think most people have some sense of what they think gentrification is. And what your book has uncovered is that there are many valences, let's say, to that idea. And people are now using it as a kind of metonym, I think was the word you used, for all kinds of other things, other phenomena. How did you get started on this topic? And why did you decide that gentrification needed a thorough etymology, if you will?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've been studying gentrification on the ground in a variety of places for over 25 years. And I've always been interested in how people who are engaged in gentrification, either as gentrifiers or as people who are being potentially displaced as gentrification unfolds, think about the process and define it and whether they use that word to describe what's happening. But what really brought me to this book was that throughout my career, I've done a lot of work to sort of interpret and synthesize academic scholarship on gentrification. In 2010, I published an edited volume, The Gentrification Debates, and I called it that because it seemed to me that there was more debate than agreement in the gentrification literature. And I organized the volume around like specific areas of debate, like where does gentrification come from? What are its consequences? Who is involved? And then I tried to sort of step away from gentrification for a little bit. And in 2017, I wrote an article for the Annual Review of Sociology on sociological literature on gentrification. And they had asked me to write this. And so I was pulled back to the literature. And as I read it, I was just struck by the degree to which those debates continued that I'd written about in 2010, but also the degree to which the debates had kind of been magnified in the sense that they were oriented around questions about how to define gentrification. And I argued that scholars were really defining gentrification in different ways, operationalizing gentrification in different ways, and therefore studying different places at different scales of gentrification, and then offering competing claims about the consequences of gentrification because they weren't looking at the same places anymore. So I was sort of sitting with the question of what does gentrification mean anymore in terms of academic scholarship, the conversations scholars are having with one another. And then I tried to step away from gentrification again, and I was doing a project, an ethnographic project, which is the kind of research I usually do, on lesbian bar commemoration in four U.S. cities. And I was immediately struck by the degree to which commemorators were emphasizing stories about how gentrification had killed the dyke bar. They were specifically interested in working class dyke bars. And what really fascinated me is that in private, commemorators would tell me, you know, I don't actually think gentrification is the main or only explanation for the loss of these bars. It's a much more complicated story. People are dating online. They're, you know, we can go to straight bars now and so on and so forth. So I got really interested in how this group was using gentrification as a device to call people together. And I ultimately argued that it created this sense of shared marginality in place of a shared singular identity politics for this group. So this was like the second thing that got me cued into the idea that Well, I guess this was really the main thing that made me think that people were using gentrification as a tool to do some things in the world. And then I'll just finally say, at the same time that these things are happening, I'm, you know, just existing in my ordinary life, and I'm reading the New York Times and the New Yorker and trying to watch things at night after my kids went to bed and reading novels. And I felt like gentrification was just following me everywhere I went. It was just incredibly present in the cultural life that I inhabit. And the world that I inhabit is not the world that everyone inhabits. But, you know, 40-something professor in Boston, this is what I was finding. And I just began to realize that academics were not the only people who were using gentrification in lots of different ways, and that Dyke Bar commemorators were not the only people using gentrification to accomplish aims that have very little to do with addressing what I think of as brick and mortar, or, borrowing from Sarah Schulman, literal gentrification, that they were using gentrification as a metaphor, a metonym, or a heuristic in order to communicate other kinds of messages or accomplish other goals. So this book is an attempt to sort of wrap my head around all of this heterogeneous use of gentrification, from scholarship to popular culture to, you know, commemorative activists.
Well, I've, anyone who's a scholar of urbanism, sociology, or basically, you know, I would think has been to college, really has probably read The Death and Life of Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs, from which the book clearly takes its inspiration for the title, at least. So I want to zone in a little bit on how much the concept of gentrification has matured since she wrote that book, which was 1961. Which actually, I guess this would be a good time to note that the text that it precedes was Judith Glass's coining of the term in 64, not much later. But when Jane Jacobs was writing, you know, she wrote the book and launched her protest movement against what I might call big urbanism and Robert Moses, where the idea of how you fixed a neighborhood was not how you look at it now, which is you go in and you surgically appropriate, you know, signals of authenticity and kind of bring them into your neoliberal capitalist scheme. Back then, it was just bulldoze everything and start over. There was no acknowledgement of the past. What do you think she would make of today's multivalent gentrifications, knowing what her values were and what she was fighting for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a wonderful question and not an easy one to answer because I have a lot of thoughts about it. I mean, I think first and foremost, I'm borrowing from the title because I want to suggest sort of, you know, that one way of defining gentrification, the way that Ruth Glass originally defined the term, has perished. That's dead. We don't have like the singular neat definition that we can all turn to. But that at the same time, gentrification is very much alive as a concept. It's just taken on new life and form, both within the academy and in popular culture. But I also, I wanted to engage Jane Jacobs because I think urban renewal is another really important point of reference for many of us who think about cities, you know, one of the most important. And I think we've lived with ideas about urban renewal that in some ways parallel ideas about gentrification. I think it's interesting to think about how we've used urban renewal. I mean, it is this incredibly powerful poster child for sort of government and elite collusion in terms of remaking cities in the interests of a few at the expense of many. And I think that's how many are oriented to think about gentrification now today. So I think I wanted to draw some parallels between the power of the example and concept of urban renewal, which of course Jane Jacobs was highlighting, and the power and resonance of gentrification as a similar poster child for contemporary problems. I also think it's fascinating to think about what Jane Jacobs' text, which was pretty widely read and has been read for, you know, many decades now, its relation to gentrification. I mean, when I have students to this day read her text and she's writing about, you know, multi-ethnic, multi, you know, class diverse neighborhoods that are densely populated and they're, you know, a mix of commerce and residential. I mean, you can see students just, they immediately just, this is their dream too, right? And this is the gentrification dream in some ways. And I don't think that's what she intended at all. But that moment in history left us with this dilemma that we're still sitting with, right? Like, do you bulldoze it or do you save it? And if you save it, whom are you saving it for, right? If we don't have any policy, you know, robust policies in place to keep that neighborhood economically and ethnically and racially heterogeneous, how is that supposed to happen, right? So in a way, it's like this primer on a kind of urbanism that many of us have come to love, but don't know how to save. And, you know, I can't remember how many years ago I went to the building she had lived in Greenwich Village. And at the time on the first floor where there was a candy shop, when I believe she owned the building, there was a votive store called Glassy Baby, I think. And it sold like a bunch of identical votives that were, I can't remember how much, but lots of money, all in just different shades, many different shades. And, you know, that's what has happened to her neighborhood, I think, in part because it was saved. So it's a legacy that I think we have to think about when we think about gentrification, not just as a material process, but also as an idea and all of the values and tastes that have fueled the process, you know, since at least the 1960s. I mean, I think in the current system, that's true, but I can imagine other systems where that would be less true. And I'm sure Sharon Zukin can as well. I mean, I think I've sometimes been thought of as perhaps more optimistic than others on this. My first book was about heterogeneity among gentrifiers in terms of their orientations to gentrification. And I argued that some gentrifiers adopt a social preservation ideology where they, you know, they participate in gentrification, but they're very aware that they are engaged in a process that leads to displacement, and they do what they can to try to limit that. And, you know, what they can do is extremely limited, but I saw them on the ground in different communities advocating for affordable housing or trying to keep, you know, a longtime residence corner store in business or make sure that schools are still welcoming to long-term residence children and churches stay in place and so on and so forth. And so, you know, on the one hand, I have a cynical take because despite all those efforts, gentrification has continued its forward march beyond what I ever would have imagined when I published that book in 2009. But on the other hand, I can see that there really is, there are boots on the ground that want to resist this, even among very privileged people who financially benefit from its progression. So I think that's sort of where I the complicated terrain on which I stand relative to all of that.
Well, the neighborhoods that you've chosen for study are quite interesting. It's interesting. I was meeting with an old friend who lives in LA, and out of the blue, as soon as I said, "Oh, on Monday I'm talking to a professor who's written a book about gentrification," he's like, "Oh my God, can I tell you about Boyle Heights?" And so maybe we can talk about that situation a little bit, how you came to center in on that. And I understand that there were at least, I believe, in your book there are two documentaries about it. One is a Netflix series, and one is a film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one is a fictional television series about a family in Boyle. I mean, they're both really about families in Boyle Heights. Hentified is one, and then the other is Vida. And I mean, I think that Boyle Heights made its way into the book twice because Boyle Heights is, again, to use the term poster child, I don't know if that's the right term, but it has an outsized location in the popular imagination of gentrification in the contemporary moment. And I think for good reason, I think in some ways it emphasizes the racial dynamics of gentrification in many places in the United States today. You know, the first many decades of gentrification in the U.S., we saw, for the most part, gentrifiers prioritize white ethnic neighborhoods. And as those neighborhoods have all become gentrified and now super gentrified in many places, the current territory that gentrifiers tend to be entering tends to be neighborhoods that belong, you know, have been home to racial minority populations. And so I think telling the story of what's happening in Boyle Heights lets us explore those current dynamics. Although interestingly, both of the works that I feature ask questions about the complicity of longtime residents in gentrification. And in different ways, I argue that they're not really telling that story to explore the complicity of Latinx populations in brick and mortar gentrification, or what Sarah Schulman calls literal gentrification, but instead their complicity in processes of economic and social mobility that are imagined to be of consequence for families and longstanding communities as some people pursue new opportunities and other people stay at home.
Yeah, I think that this is where the conflation of the term gentrification really does start to get complex, because I guess the insight to me, it reads that, you know, neoliberalism and sort of unabashed capital infuses not only urban planning policy, but our conceptions of ourselves. So especially like this group in Boyle Heights, which is, you know, predominantly Latinx, as you say, you know, the way that people in minority or underprivileged groups who are affected by literal gentrification view themselves and their families and friends through a lens of like individual choice, which is such a paradigm of neoliberal capitalism, right? It's like the state's not in this equation at all. Like the consequences might be there because, okay, the taxes are higher or, you know, this is more expensive, but they're not looking at it that way. They're not saying like, oh, this is a systemic problem that we need to take to City Hall or we need to take to our elected representatives. It's like, no, you sold out. You sold out. You're acting straight. You're acting bougie. You're acting white. You know, or you're all highfalutin now because you went and got an education. Shame on you for coming back to the neighborhood and trying to improve it. Like, that's the attitude. Like, wow. So why do you think this is, and what do we do about it? When I say we, I mean, there are three white people on this call. Like, is it even our job? Like, how do we intervene?
Yeah. Right. Which just points to how limited we feel, tools are when it comes to pulling in government or planning or robust policies that would help prevent, you know, secure affordable housing and maybe stabilize long-term businesses. Actually, at one of my first book events, at a bookstore, a young urban planning student came and said, you know, I would love to plan communities that have bike lanes and parks, but every time I propose including those amenities, someone says, you know, this is going to lead to gentrification and displacement. And, you know, what do we do? Do we allow neighborhoods to have no amenity, you know, to be deprived of these amenities to avoid gentrification? And what an unfair set of choices. And I think the narrative that we see in Gentified and in Vida, I see as borrowing from, you know, sort of the age old American dream ideology, the idea that you can pull yourself up by the bootstraps. So it's, you know, you can renovate your house and turn a neighborhood around. You alone can do this as an individual. You can find a way to college and get yourself out of, you know, the neighborhood that you grew up in. But now, you know, some were precluded from that dream for a long time. And I think it's worth pausing and reflecting on critically that now that more social groups hopefully have access to social mobility, that we are encountering these narratives that say, look, you gentrified yourself, that are critical of this upward mobility, right? It's not achieving the dream, it's selling out. And I think there's always been some of that, but I find it fascinating that now there seem to be multiple, you know, there are novels, there are, you know, memoirs and now television series and films that are all about personal responsibility to staying connected to home and family by not engaging in literal gentrification and also by not engaging in upward mobility. And, you know, I think every cultural object that I engage in this book, I admire. I think they're great television series, they're great novels. But when we look at them as a whole, I worry very much about this narrative that holds individuals responsible. And I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, we're offering these critical narratives about upward mobility and mapping them onto gentrifying neighborhoods or situating them in gentrifying neighborhoods, because it mirrors an overly simple way of thinking about gentrification that I think has persisted popularly, but also in the academic literature for a long time, which is the idea that gentrification is driven by individuals moving into neighborhoods and making individual property decisions rather than, you know, a broad scale response to the very intentional, you know, talk about urban renewal, like disinvestment, redlining, all of these choices that brought urban markets to their knees and created this vacuum that allowed people to come in and invest in highly disinvested urban neighborhoods and allowed gentrification to take root. So the story for me has never really been about individual actors. I had someone come to a book event who seemed ready to get in an argument about gentrification. And he raised his hand and said, you know, if there's a person and they have the option to buy a $400,000 house in an already gentrified neighborhood or a $200,000 house somewhere else, how can you blame them for buying the $200,000 house? And I said, you know, I don't think we should. I think that's a wrong way of thinking about things, to blame people for this, because people are embedded in markets and their choices are limited. I think we have to think about how people ought to act responsibly and fight for affordable housing. But we have to understand that people are embedded in opportunity structures and markets. And that's true when we think about literal gentrification and this, you know, idea that I find on television and in novels of the metaphorical gentrification of the self.
I'm thinking about another cultural artifact that is touched on very early in the book, but not returned to. And I can understand why, because the object is, well, it talks about a lot of other things besides urban gentrification, but I loved the show The Curse, which was, for those who don't know it, an absolutely brutal satire of the HGTV type house flipper show with Nathan Fielder and Emma Stone as a sort of designer couple who think it's a good idea to come into a real community, which does exist in New Mexico, Española, which is in very poor shape. It's really rough, big drug problems, a lot of poverty, et cetera. And they come up with these designs that have like these huge reflective walls all the way around. And it just, you know, sheds light back. It just reflects light back into the community. They look like mirror glass. It's completely not what the community is. And they're so, so earnest, and they're really trying to incorporate everyone in their scheme, and they run into all kinds of problems. And I won't give away the spoilers, but it is really uncomfortable. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that show and how that fits into your study, your work.
Yeah. So I have to admit that I didn't finish the series. So when it came out, I was in the very final stages of revising the book, and I was very tempted to write about it, and I made myself stop because I was too far along in the revisions of the book. And, you know, I could tell you a lot of stories of, you know, in some ways, the story of this book is stories of me trying to walk away from gentrification. And then in my leisure time, stumbling upon, you know, representations of gentrification that I feel called to write about. And this was one of them. But from the parts that I saw, I mean, I absolutely agree that it was a brutal satire of HGTV. And I think it's very much along the lines of the kind of critique of rescue capitalism that I write about in Robert Goldman's book, Renovating Value, which is also about HGTV. So the synergies between the two from what I saw of the series were interesting. And a few things did stand out to me, and this is why I was getting very tempted to write about it, because I think that almost from the get-go, it becomes clear that the, you know, the showrunners are confident that we all know what gentrification is. They call it the G word. So they don't even have to say it, and we know it's happening. And really interestingly, this is a relatively small town where they're, you know, engaging in gentrification. And I don't think that they expect any dissonance in terms of people traditionally thinking of gentrification as only happening in Manhattan or something. So the degree to which the idea has range and stretch, I think, is also really apparent in the show. You know, and I think that's good. I mean, I think the portability of the concept is a good thing. But then the other thing that's really clear from what I watched of the show is that, as in many of the representations of gentrification that I engage in the book, you know, there's good guys and there's bad guys. And this is part of, I think, also what drove me to write the book, is the degree to which we've made gentrification this really neat moral story. And that's part of why it becomes portable. And I think there's really some risks to telling these narratives over and over again, where there's, like, you know, a couple of people who are driving this and they're bad and the rest of us are kind of okay. Before another bookstore event, I decided I was going to watch TV and sort of zone out. And I'd never watched the British version of Law and Order. And I turned on an episode and it was all about gentrification. And the two investigators get in sort of an argument about whether gentrification is good or bad within the first few minutes of the series. But anyway, the plot line is about an evil developer who actually, like, ends up killing a baby by tampering with a heating device and a unit. And, you know, these stories end up leaving us sort of with the idea that if you get rid of the evil landlord, who in this case goes to jail, you've solved the problem. And if we really care about, you know, brick and mortar gentrification, I think thinking that if we just get rid of the evil landlord, or, you know, the terrible house flippers, we're going to be okay, is really problematic and a really overly simple way of thinking about these things. Sorry, that was a long answer to your question.
I want to ask, is there an endpoint for gentrification in your mind? One of my favorite Onion headlines ever is gentrifier is being pushed out by aristocratization, where they show, you know, foppish aristocrats showing up. And that's effectively what's happened in Brooklyn and in the West Village. Two stories jump out is that, you know, Brooklyn, I was a younger gentrifier myself, perhaps, in Carroll Gardens back in the day. But there we've seen over a process of years of something like thousands of units have been removed from the rental market because people are consolidating brownstones. My old brownstone on 128 Pacific Street was purchased by a food influencer and her DJ boyfriend and gutted the entire building to turn to a single residence. So I always think of that as very classic. And then the New York Times recently had a story about Jane Jacobs' West Village, where, you know, global wealth is consolidating multiple brownstones into hidden mansions behind the scenes. I think of that, and I think of the news report, John Burns Murdoch at the Financial Times, that does their visualizations, point out that basically housing starts in London have dropped to zero. Like total inertia. And so that's my question, is like, is the ultimate outcome of gentrification the heat death of the city? Like, it just reaches complete freezing point as a storehouse for capital, or where does it end?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible. My colleague Loretta Lees coined the term super gentrification to describe, you know, exactly what you're describing in Carroll Gardens, right? So, you know, doctors and lawyers getting priced out by the uber wealthy. And then, you know, exactly what you're describing. I also wonder if at some point, you know, is it still gentrification? Do we want to, is it even super gentrification, or is it something even beyond that? And now, you know, I think when we think about private equity buying up lots of properties in order to sort of hold them or flip them or whatever they're doing, is that another thing too? And that you know, that is a major dynamic in a lot of places right now. And so I do think that we're up against the limits of thinking of these things as gentrification, at least as Ruth Glass defined the term in 1964, which was, you know, the professional class as moving into working class space. And we see that less and less. Now, that in certain cities, we see that less and less because many of these neighborhoods have been upscaled many times at this point. But there still are, you know, to use Neil Smith's terminology, gentrification frontiers, even in the United States and certainly globally, where we see more classical gentrification happening. I do wonder, you know, at what point, you know, are people not going to be drawn to cities in any way because of this? And certainly not the classes, not the kids who used to go live in Carroll Gardens, right? I had a friend who years ago said, he went to Wesleyan and he said, someone should just be studying where the Wesleyan, you know, graduates move every year in Brooklyn, and then you'll know where the next place to gentrify is. But can that even be true anymore? I mean, so yeah, especially to the degree to which people are looking for affordability, or, you know, listeners won't see, you know, grittiness and authenticity in quotes, but I very much mean it in quotation marks. You know, if that's what they're seeking, you're not going to find that in, many major cities in the United States today. So that's another way in which I think gentrification may be dying, if not dead, or at least classical gentrification.
Well, it is interesting how it gets back to those notions of taste. Yeah, your point about grittiness and authenticity there. And there's also a generational aspect I feel out of this about the precarity that younger people feel about whether that even matters to them in that context. But it is interesting. I mean, Richard Florida argued for years, I know across multiple books, that when places get too rich and too boring, rich people leave, which I actually never actually agreed with. I think plenty of rich people are happy to be boring. And there's an entire like taste discourse around this. But I want to steer back. You know, obviously post-book, I'm curious your thoughts on the current policy landscape to ameliorate this. You have the abundance bros and the YIMBYs out there demanding that we upzone and build more in dense cities to do this. And then you have Mayor Mamdani, for example, who seems to be trying to navigate this idea of doing rent protections on one side and then doing YIMBYism on the other side as a way to balance it. And I'm curious your thoughts on his approach or any other kind of balanced policy approach to handle this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we have to be fighting this on every possible front. So I am, you know, especially living in a city that got rid of rent control in the 1990s, in a state that got rid of rent control in the 1990s. I mean, it certainly seems to me that we need rent control, we need rent stabilization, and we need higher density. I don't believe that higher density alone solves anything unless you're protecting it as affordable. And I also think we have to absolutely preserve remaining brick and mortar affordable housing that we have. So, you know, there's a move to transform a lot of that into mixed income housing in certain cities. And I worry about that greatly because I think we need every single unit we can get that is affordable. I know in Boston, there's a move by some housing activists to advocate for housing that's affordable in perpetuity. So it doesn't time out at some point, because what they're seeing is that as the original inhabitants who have been able to gain economic stability and even wealth generation sometimes by having purchased affordably, they benefited from that, but then their children and grandchildren cannot move back to the neighborhoods. You know, for whom are we keeping things affordable? And they're seeing just communities disrupted and neighborhoods disrupted. So I think this move towards affordability and perpetuity may be an important tool that needs to be in the mix, especially in very expensive cities. But I would say overall, I mean, if there's one takeaway from this book, I think that it's that at least a certain segment of cultural producers in the US is very confident that work that presents gentrification, whether literal gentrification or metaphorical gentrification, as a problem will be well received, right? And we're not supposed to think the G word is a good thing. I don't think when people are using it, it has like a critical biting edge to it. And I think I think there's promise in that. I think that means that there's some appetite that probably even a decade or two ago wasn't there among sort of what Wendy Griswold calls the reading classes, at least, because that's sort of what this book speaks to in terms of the archive that it's drawing from, to think really critically about these issues. And I think we see that with, you know, Mamdani and recent mayoral elections in Seattle and Boston, that people are deeply concerned about these issues and maybe more ready than ever to think about how we address them. Although I have to say one thing that's less optimistic, which is that I do think that the degree to which we're using gentrification as a rallying cry in all of this, the fact that we aren't sure what gentrification is anymore, is potentially a problem, because what policy are you supposed to pull out to address gentrification if we're talking about the super, super gentrification of Carroll Gardens, or, you know, an earlier stage gentrification of Mattapan in Boston, for instance, or if we're talking about metaphorical gentrification or gentrification HGTV style in, you know, a small southwestern town. So I think that's a problem.
I mean, so I think the great thing to close on then would be, you know, you mentioned as one of your objectives in writing the book is that we move forward with intentionality about how we use gentrification. So how do you think we should use it?
I mean, I think we should all be in the habit of saying what we mean when we use the term. And I think it's okay if we have different meanings that, you know, are inherent when we use the term, but we must be explicit about that. I think many people are trying to do this, at least in the academic world that I inhabit, by hyphenating gentrification. So green gentrification, studentification, touristification, climate gentrification, and I could rural gentrification, I could go on and on. And I think that that's a desire to be more specific, you know, about what one is talking about, and specificity in terms of what's driving gentrification, who's engaged in gentrification, where it's happening, what stage it's at. I think that's all important. I also wonder if gentrification has reached, not as a process necessarily in all places, but as a term, is nearing the end of its utility, in part because, you know, that the early gentrification that Ruth Glass described in 1964 has become, you know, a major way of organizing the economic life of cities. And so this isn't just sort of an ad hoc process of some people moving into working class neighborhoods one by one, right? I mean, that's how she describes it. This is not a one by one process anymore. And maybe if we have a term that better captures the degree to which government and neoliberalism and all the things that some of the authors I engage in the book call out are really driving this process, we'll do a better job of addressing it. I don't know. So I hope I'm inviting more debate and conversation about both how to define the term and whether we should keep using it.
So do you have any candidates for what should replace it?
I think there should be many candidates. So, you know, I think if we're going to use the language of gentrification, there are gentrifications. This is a plural thing at this point. There is no singular gentrification, I don't think. We can talk about, I like to think about classical gentrification. I think I've used that a few times. But, you know, there isn't a singular gentrification anymore. So we probably need multiple different terms to describe the different processes that are happening. And I think many of them appear in the book. You know, I argue that some people who are writing about gentrification are really talking about, you know, Goldman's talking about rescue capitalism. I think some people are zeroed in on neoliberalism. That's really what's happening. Other people are much more worried about, you know, the current state of capitalism. Yeah, I don't know. It's a hard question. I think there's a move towards talking about displacement and affordability as much as gentrification. And I do think that that's important, because I think naming the outcomes rather than the cause in some case may be helpful, because it's really displacement and unaffordability that I think many of us want to address.
Yeah, it seems like I also, from a political project, that people, of course, still, the average American still sees their home as their store of value. It's a political project to basically invite people who are gentrifying. See, here I go back to the word, but to invite them to understand that you want to allow the participants of that neighborhood to participate in that. The displacement is the crime there. Maybe there's an argument for that one too, but I do wonder how we get past it. Well, I hope for your next book you get to coin your own Richard Floridianism and get to dominate that subject even further, because yes, your work on this is fantastic and engaging. Thank you so much for joining us on Frozen. Dan, you want to have the last question, last word?
No, I think you've nailed it there, Greg. I will point out that for those who don't have the visual here, I think of the old enemy of authenticity in neighborhoods seems a lot less threatening now, but there is a sign for Starbucks with an arrow that's pointing directly at Greg's head right now. And just to underscore the point, that was the only thing we worried about. It was like, oh God, it's Starbucks coming in to get rid of all the coffee shops. And now there's so many indie coffee shops, and that is itself a vector of gentrification.
Well, although
Starbucks has middle brown now, and but we Starbucks have to worry about like, the next
that's
stage.
What people, you know, in rural farm communities can get Starbucks.
Well, honestly, you can look at the exemplar of like Blank Street Coffee, which is a venture capital backed chain that basically uses site selection tools to go into neighborhoods with thriving independent coffee shops and frack them down. And yeah, we were discussing earlier, I mean, in addition to the hedge funds buying up Brooklyn apartments, you have Goldman Sachs having its own urban investment fund that was backing, you know, beer gardens in Crown Heights, Brooklyn to this too. So yeah, David Harvey echoes in my mind, the spatial fix of economic geography is now like the walkable neighborhood and the value in that too.
Yes, absolutely.
We are all implicated. I have a receipt for reimbursement that is sitting on my desk from Blank Street Coffee in DC. And now I feel a little bit guilty because I didn't know what it was. Yes. I didn't know what it was. I was like, this is cool. Like, I just want a nice coffee.
Yeah, we are all implicated, but also when there are hedge funds involved, we have to keep our eye on that as well, I think. So it's a balance.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try to live the rest of my day get out from under the specter of shame. Death and Life of Gentrification, A New Map of a Persistent Idea, Japonica Brown Saraceno. Thank you very much for joining us on Unfrozen today.
Thank you so much. It was really great to talk with you both.